Hi, my name is Arun Venkatesan, and I'm here to talk about the Encephalitis Center and our efforts to better diagnose and treat encephalitis.
And I'm Elizabeth Tracy. So why don't we start first with encephalitis? Why don't we just define that?
Well, that's a very important point. The definition of encephalitis is often, when you look in literature, not very clear. But I think the way that we view encephalitis is infection or inflammation of the brain.
There can be, of course, multiple causes of this particular outcome.
That's absolutely right. So for some people, when they think about encephalitis, they think about an infection of the brain. And it's certainly true that infection is a common cause of encephalitis, but there are also many non-infectious causes of encephalitis. And I think it's important to think about all of these causes broadly when a patient comes into the emergency room, because you may be going down the wrong road if you're solely focused on infection.
Before we start talking about infection and other causes of encephalitis, why don't we back up just a little bit and talk about how many people suffer encephalitis every year, and are they disproportionately more younger people, older people, children?
Approximately 1 in 100,000 people get encephalitis every year. It does tend to affect children more than adults.
So it's pretty common, pretty significant. Why would it be important for there to be an encephalitis center such as the one here at Johns Hopkins?
Truthfully, there really hasn't been a lot of progress in understanding the causes of encephalitis or how to treat encephalitis over the past many years. I think that the tools that we have had in the past really haven't been sufficient to advance the field. And so when you look at outcomes in terms of patients who come in with encephalitis, they haven't changed dramatically aside from the fact that many patients now are cared for in intensive care unit settings. We really have not developed new therapies or new abilities to impact the outcome of these patients. So we thought it was very important to get together a multidisciplinary group to try to better study the problem and to better address the problems that patients face.
So you already foreshadowed for us that almost all patients with encephalitis are going to enter the hospital through the emergency department. Tell me just a little more about that. Would that mean that someone would be transferred here in order to be evaluated?
That's absolutely right. Patients with encephalitis are generally pretty sick, and they generally know that they're sick and either come to the emergency room on their own or are brought to the emergency room by concerned family members or friends. In general, we accept transfers of patients from other hospitals to our encephalitis center, or we have patients who come to our emergency room who then are brought into the encephalitis center here. It's very rare that a patient would actually contact us directly. This is a very acute process. It's far more likely that it would occur through the emergency room.
What tools, what diagnostic techniques, what treatments do we have now that are different than we had just a very short time ago that would improve outcomes for people with encephalitis?
So we've adopted a number of new ideas and new techniques that we think are really going to help patients with encephalitis. And I'll give you a few examples of that. One is, as part of our multidisciplinary effort, we've gotten together and come up with a diagnostic algorithm for encephalitis. So in other words, a way to evaluate patients in a standardized fashion who present with signs and symptoms consistent with encephalitis. And this may sound like a simple or a trivial exercise. It turns out that we're finding out that in many branches of medicine, coming up with good, sound guidelines have great potential to change outcomes in patients. So checklists, guidelines, etc., are now more and more commonly integrated into the medical approach. Another good example of this is when patients are transferred to us, they come with a stack of records. We look through those records and we see that a number of tests have been ordered, but may not have been ordered in a rational manner. Often what happens is patients come into the hospital, they're really sick, and physicians try to do everything they can to figure out what's wrong with the patient. In doing so, important tests can actually be missed. We've seen that at other hospitals. That happens at our hospital as well. And so we thought it best to put together a standardized guideline for tests that you might order. And we did this in a tiered approach. We would administer a certain set of tests, and depending on the results of those, we would then administer a next set of tests, and so on. And we're now in the process of evaluating how well this works. We think it's going to work pretty well, and if so, we are planning to share this with the rest of the encephalitis community so that we can improve the diagnostic approach to these patients.
So do you mind giving me just one example of something important that may have been missed in the absence of this particular algorithm?
Absolutely. A really good example of a situation in which we've seen tests that simply have not been ordered is the example of West Nile virus encephalitis. As you probably know, West Nile has become more of a problem over the last several years and has the potential to cause encephalitis. It does so during certain seasons, in the late summer to late fall to early winter. So if that's not on one's radar, and if that's not part of a standardized algorithm, then we've actually seen that get missed. And that can have some pretty significant consequences.
Encephalitis, of course, is commonly associated with lots of long-term problems in people who survive. How does the implementation of an algorithm like this help to potentially avoid some of those problems?
Well, you're absolutely right that many patients who develop encephalitis simply do not do well from a long-term standpoint. And we actually think that the best way to improve patient outcomes in the long run is to treat them well in the acute setting. And that's really what we've been focused on. We are attempting to evaluate patients very soon after the development of their symptoms and to treat them very soon after the development of their symptoms. So using the algorithm, for example, we can identify the cause of the encephalitis sooner. Using other approaches that we've developed can also help. We represent a collaboration between the Neurocritical Care Division and the Neuroinfectious Disease Division. We also have other departments involved in the Encephalitis Center. Patients with encephalitis often develop seizures, and these seizures can be very, very difficult to treat. And what we know about seizures is that if you continue to have seizures, it's not good for the brain, and it can cause permanent damage. And so we've been very aggressive now about monitoring patients for seizure activity in the acute setting. By monitoring patients, we can actually treat them more effectively, we can control their seizures better, and we're now looking at whether that affects their long-term outcome. We're pretty certain that it will.
It's sounding this argument for an acute care center and an algorithm to help to facilitate treatment. It sounds pretty compelling to me. Would you suggest that just like centers of excellence for stroke treatment, that would also be a viable model for the treatment of encephalitis?
Well, I think that makes sense. We're moving more into an era in medicine where people tend to specialize in certain disorders. And we found that when you have specialists who take care of you, outcomes can generally be better. I think it makes sense to have a center where physicians are devoted to the care of a particular condition in order to advance the diagnosis and treatment of that condition.
Outside of validation of the algorithm with regard to treatment, what else are research efforts that are on the horizon for you?
One of the major efforts that we're undertaking is pathogen discovery. So it turns out that we can only identify the cause of encephalitis in less than half of the patients who have the condition. So we have a long way to go in terms of understanding what causes encephalitis. We're now using some very advanced genetic techniques and molecular biological techniques to try to identify novel or new pathogens that might cause encephalitis. On the flip side, we discussed that there are a number of causes of encephalitis that are non-infectious. Another major research effort is going into characterizing the immune response in patients with acute encephalitis. And we think that that's going to tell us a lot about whether the encephalitis is likely infectious or non-infectious. And if it's non-infectious, what immune therapies may be best to use to treat the patient.
Do you think it would be wise for patients themselves to ask to be transferred to a center such as this one?
I think so. We think that both from a clinical standpoint and from the standpoint of advancing the research that we're in a good position to help in both settings. I think the important thing to remember here is that at this point, we're really focused on acute encephalitis. So we think we have the best chance to make a difference within the first week or so of patients developing encephalitis. At this point, we are not yet focused on rehabilitation or longer term issues in patients with encephalitis. We will likely build that into our program as we go along. For now, we're focused on that acute setting.
Very good. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.